Hello, in tonight's Quantum Leap, high-tech science that's helping to produce healthy plants for your garden. How much of a problem are the grey squirrels in Dublin's Phoenix Park? A new festival of engineering that starts on Monday, and why our spring weather is so unstable. But we begin with the next big thing in computing, and no, I don't mean Windows Vista. Quantum computing is something of a holy grail for computer scientists, exploiting the weird and wonderful world of quantum mechanics to create computers that can do calculations in seconds that would take the best supercomputer years to complete. Now, scientists around the world, including some in Ireland, are working on various ways to try and make this happen, and they've had some success in the past in doing small quantum computations. But this week, a Canadian company unveiled what it claims is the world's first commercial quantum computer. Well, to tell me more, I'm joined on the line by technology journalist Peter Judge. Peter, in outline, what is a quantum computer?
As you say, it uses the strange effects of quantum mechanics to allow it to carry out things in parallel at the same time.
And this Canadian company, D-Wave Systems, claims to have unveiled a quantum computer. I mean, what have they got?
They've got 16 quantum bits. Now, a quantum bit is like a bit in an ordinary computer, except that because it's a quantum bit, it's not one or zero, it's one and zero. And that means you can carry out two calculations with it at the same time. Obviously, if you double that, you get four. If you double that again, you get eight. By the time you get to 16 quantum bits, you're carrying out something like about 65,000 calculations at the same time. It's like having multiple computers in parallel universes, if you like.
What does it look like? Have you any idea? Have you seen this?
I haven't seen it. I've seen photos of it. The chip itself is a tiny chip. It's not particularly state-of-the-art for making chips. It uses a kind of fabrication technology that any silicon vendor can do. But it's a small chip with these 16 quantum bits on it. But that will be completely surrounded by the paraphernalia to make it cold enough and isolated enough from the rest of the world for quantum effects to happen. They've got to get it down to something, you know, very close to absolute zero. So there'll be huge refrigeration equipment and filters to remove noise from the system. Lots of electronics around it.
And absolute zero is minus 273 degrees Celsius. So that's pretty cold. And you say these bits are both one and zero at the same time. So this is like Schrödinger's cat. It's dead and alive until you open the box, is it?
Exactly. And, if you can imagine this as being getting both those cats, say, doing useful work with both of those cats. It's having your quantum cat and eating it. As long as you keep the system isolated from the rest of the world, a quantum system exists in all the states it possibly can. So it is just like quantum Schrödinger's cat.
Okay, the Schrödinger's computer. So this Canadian company, they're called D-Wave Systems. We'll put a link to their website from our website. Who is their computer aimed at?
I think the first people they're hoping to sell it to when they can eventually sell it will be people who need big computers and have lots of money riding on the outcome of what they do. In other words, financial modelers, biotechnologists, and that sort of thing. The idea of this is it will solve problems of optimization, where you've got multiple possible inputs to a system and you want to know which one is the best.
They claim it's commercial. I'm gathering from you it's not actually on sale at the moment. When will it be on sale or available?
First of all, they're going to make it available on the web. So they'll have they're going to go up from 16 quantum bits, which 16 quantum bits is useful, but still doesn't do anything that you couldn't do in a reasonable length of time with a conventional computer. So they'll take it up to 256 quantum bits, and they're promising to release an open source user interface on a website, so that for people presumably who pay, can get to use time on the quantum computer. That's meant to be happening, they say, sometime this year. And then beyond that, they are talking about creating one that goes in a standard computer rack, a 19-inch rack mount, plugs into an ordinary power supply, has all the refrigeration equipment miniaturized down, and could even be delivered into computer rooms, but very rich computer rooms, I would imagine.
I would imagine. Final quick question. Does this mean that the search for a quantum computer is over, or all the other international teams, are they going to keep doing their different approaches?
Absolutely not. The search continues, And there are multiple different ways of doing quantum computers. There is going to be a lot of discussion about whether this has actually done anything really useful. Because until if you imagine quantum computing is revolutionary enough, this is a breakthrough within that. It's a thing called an adiabatic quantum computer. So far, they've only existed on paper. There's and people are unsure, actually, to what extent the theory of adiabatic quantum computing translates into reality. So there's been a demonstration, but no sort of published, verifiable, repeatable work on it. So the search will continue, for sure, and the search for different kinds of quantum computers. It might be that this one has solved one particular problem. It might turn out that it's not as easy to generalize that to other problems as D-Wave are hoping. Anything could still happen at this stage.
Okay, very good. But still, nonetheless, it's a quantum leap for quantum computers.
A quantum leap for quantum computers, exactly.
Thank you, Peter Judge.
Great.
You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Still to come, the wonders of engineering and some high-tech horticulture. But first, squirrels have been in the news lately. The numbers of small native red squirrels are plummeting, and it's generally accepted that their big, brash American cousins, the grey squirrels, are at least partly to blame. Now, if we're to tackle the grey squirrel, then we'll need to know more about them. And one good place to start is Dublin's Phoenix Park, and that's where zoologists from UCD are now doing a detailed study of the grey squirrel population. Well, earlier I caught up with the researchers, and while the students were off trapping and tagging squirrels, I asked team leader Dr. Tom Hayden just how big a problem were grey squirrels in the park.
Well, it just so happens that this year several initiatives have come together addressing squirrels. One is an initiative countrywide to produce a census of squirrels, or at least a current distribution map, mainly with the view of protecting forests. The second, there's been a survey of grey squirrel damage and tree damage going on in the Phoenix Park because they're a significant pest of new plantations, particularly of broadleaf trees. And thirdly, it's become a matter of interest because Dublin is launching its biodiversity action plan, and that would be, squirrels would be a component of this, more particularly the red squirrel rather than the grey squirrel, which is in serious decline in Dublin now.
How big a problem are grey squirrels in the Phoenix Park?
A substantial problem because they do a lot of damage to broadleaf trees, and most of the trees in the park now are, I guess, past their sell-by date, so there's a substantial program of planting being going on in the last 10 years or so, and it's due to continue. But the foresters are of the general opinion that throughout the countryside in perhaps decades to come, we'll notice that there are fewer mature trees than we might expect because the squirrels are preventing the young trees from getting established.
You've been surveying, or you and your students in the Mammal Study Group in UCD, you're starting to survey the grey squirrel population in the Phoenix Park. What have you found so far?
Well, at the moment, we're just trying to look at the distribution of squirrels within the park and trying to estimate the population densities. There are two reasons we're interested in them in the park. The first one is because, as I say, the possibility of trying to control them to lessen the impact on the trees. And the second is, it has often been considered in a general sort of way that it might be a useful initiative to try and reintroduce red squirrels to the park. Now, red squirrels were once common in Dublin, and now they're reduced to a few small populations that are isolated from one another. And they're certainly doomed in the short term. But if one is to attempt a reintroduction program, you first of all have to try and address the factors that cause the extinction in the first place. And we are pretty sure that the grey squirrel's got something to do with this, although precisely how is rather less clear.
We're standing today now outside the visitor centre in the Phoenix Park, which many will people know near the Ashtown Gate, and the place is hooching with grey squirrels.
It is. This is probably one of the areas with the highest density of grey squirrels. We've just been trapping the squirrel, live trapping the squirrels for the past month or so, tagging them and releasing them to try and get an estimate of exactly how many there are. And we were rather surprised to find that in 1 hectare there were somewhere between 50 and 60. I'm not sure what the exact count is now, but a week or so ago there were more than 50.
That's a huge number in an area the size of a hectare.
It is. I think this is purely resource related. In other words, there's lots of food for them here, and it's not food from the visitor centre because they're not being fed. They don't get any food from the visitor centre, although they are very good at raiding bins in the zoo. There's also a very high density of grey squirrels in the zoo. Of course, there's lots of food around, naturally enough, for feeding the other animals.
Is the Phoenix Park a source of squirrels? Is it exporting squirrels to the surrounding neighbourhood or importing them from the neighbourhood? What do we know?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know, because we set out to try and estimate the population density in various places in the park, and the first area we hit on, there were so many squirrels, we never got out of it. So we're proceeding to move on and to try and sort out exactly whether it's what biologists call a source or a sink. In other words, it's releasing squirrels over the wall, or they're coming the other way. One way to do this, which we're just gearing up to, is to do it by genetic means. That if we actually look at the genetic fingerprints, if you like, of squirrels in the park, we can get an idea of what geneticists call gene flow, whether effectively genes are moving into the park or out of the park. We can get some idea of that. We've just demonstrated that we can technically do it. We've done some genetic work on some of the squirrels from here using hairs that we plucked from the squirrels when we caught them. So we have a reasonable expectation that we might be able to map, if you like, something about the movement of squirrels in the park without following them at all. Although we have done this, we've put radio transmitters on some of them, see where they're going.
And how realistic is it, once we know something about the grey squirrel population, to think about reintroducing reds into the Phoenix Park?
Well, the first problem will be to consider the removal of the grey squirrels in the first place, and I yet honestly don't know how feasible that's likely to be. There's been a substantial amount of efforts trying to control grey squirrels as a pest of forests in Ireland, but rather more so in Britain. And in general terms, it's a sort of a full-time job trying to keep on top of them. Whether we could be any more successful here or not, I don't know. And before one could be permitted to try and release red squirrels, you'd need to have demonstrated that the grey squirrel population was substantially decreased. This has implications. How are you going to do it? And there are ethical and humane considerations to be dealt with first.
That's a detailed survey of the squirrel population. Last time we met you was back in September, and you and your research group were doing a detailed study of the deer population here. What were the results from that study?
Well, we've been studying those since about 1987, studying various aspects of the deer, from short-term interactions and behaviour and so on to factors that affect their lifetime reproductive success. And this time we're now concentrating a bit on the vocalisations they make, and it's the sounds they make, because these deer, for anybody who's been in the park in October, are extremely noisy.
And that's at the rutting season,
during the rutting season.
The males are out there trying to attract the males.
So what we've been doing is we've been making recordings from these males, and we're trying to determine, first of all, whether or not the males sound different. In other words, have they got different voices, and could the females use these voices to recognise males? And the second question is, if they have different voices, can we recognise what it is about the voices of successful males? In other words, is there some signal in the way they speak, as it were?
And what did you find?
Well, we find that there are some differences between successful males and unsuccessful males in terms of how they sound, and most males, on a computer at least, we can actually tell them apart by making phonograms and making measurements. Of course, we're not female deer, so what the female deer make of all this is anybody's guess. But another of my colleagues, Jackie Fox, is trying to test this out. She's using these recordings from males that have been successful in the park and those that have not, and playing them back to female deer on farms who've never heard them to see what they think of them, see if they're interested or not. First of all, can they tell them apart? And we're pretty certain they can tell some of them apart, and they seem to be more interested in some than in others. But it's early days yet, because, of course, the female deer on the farm don't understand it's an important experiment. They have views of their own on this.
Zoologist Dr. Tom Hayden from University College Dublin talking to us there in his outdoor research laboratory, or as it's known to the rest of us, the Phoenix Park. Very good. Now, have you ever wanted to build a robot or a car, or maybe test drive a flight simulator? Do you want to discover the chemistry used in special effects, or maybe you just want to see inside a power station? Well, these are just some of the activities on offer for the country's first ever Festival of Engineering. It starts next Monday, runs all week. It's organised by Engineers Ireland. That's the professional body that represents engineers here. Joining me to explain why they're organising a week-long festival is engineer Margie McCarthy. You're calling this the Week of Wonder. What kinds of things can people take part in?
Well, the whole idea behind the Week of Wonder was that we wanted to gear this towards families and getting them involved in interactive events as much as possible. So really the whole week is geared towards 8 to 14 year olds plus their parents, because it is during the midterm break, so we're aiming to get people out there and involved. They can get involved in a whole range of activities all through the country.
Such as?
From the Steps to Engineering point of view, we are running treasure hunts in Cork on the Monday, in Galway on Tuesday, Athlone Wednesday, and Dublin on the Thursday.
And what's the engineering involved in a treasure hunt?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's all about meeting the wonders of engineering in each of those locations. So we have, for instance, in Cork, the Navy are involved. They're also involved in Galway, so people will be able to go on board and figure out a navigational challenge. Each of the treasure hunts, the kids will have to achieve between 5 and 7 challenges, as well as answer questions. Each of the treasure hunts also involves making your own robot that can draw, that you can take away with you. Some of them will involve going into Dublin Castle, experiencing a flight simulator, and learning about the engineering behind that. Other places, Athlone Castle will be involved. We'll have Trinity College involved, and a lot of the engineering departments there have put together all different types of challenges, from prototyping to building structures. So it just shows the diversity and the range of engineering to people taking part.
Very much aimed at families and school groups?
Yes, very much. We are, as I said, aiming for 8 to 14. Now, we can take a little younger and a little older. Some of the other activities that are happening during the week, and we have all of them on the website, weekofwonder.ie, all of those can be, some of them are geared towards 16 to 19 year olds, for instance. There are other events as well for adults, but primarily most of them are geared towards the 8 to 14 year old.
Why are you doing this?
Well, as the Steps to Engineering programme, where all of our activities are geared at promoting engineering as a career option, both at primary and post-primary school level. So we carry out a whole range of activities during the school year. But what we find when we go into the classroom is that once we get kids aware of engineering, they become very excited about it. But there's a huge perception out there that it's all about hard hats and muddy boots. And I come from the civil side, so I can say that I spent 5 months of my 10 years working in civil engineering with a hard hat on. So, I mean, there's that perception, and we're trying to get rid of it, basically, and show people what the diversities are. And so the whole week is geared towards increasing awareness of how diverse
engineering is. Well, I can see why a lot of this would be an enjoyable day out. Are you hoping it will translate into numbers of people going on to study engineering?
Well, we'll hope it'll spark an interest and at least increase just the awareness of, for instance, biomedical industry and the electronic side. And all of these kids are walking around with MP3 players and all this kind of technology. We want them to realise that as engineers of the future, they could be responsible for the new technologies of tomorrow. So by doing that and increasing the awareness through the National Week, we hope that that'll eventually translate into subject choices of science subjects and eventually onto choosing engineering in their CAO forms.
Do we need more engineers in the country?
We do. We do. This is a long debated question. When you look at the type of technology that we're growing into, I mean, traditionally, a lot of people have heard of Ireland Inc. and the whole knowledge economy, and scientists and engineers will be the people who feed the knowledge economy. If you look at job announcements over the last year even, you look at the R&D centres that are being centred here in Ireland as the European centres, even for Google, Dell, Xilinx, all of these really exciting industries. We've even got small indigenous companies like Havoc, who are responsible for creating the background computing against computer games like Lara Croft, that sort of thing. And we need the engineers to feed this industry, which at the moment we're meeting with immigrant graduates coming in, because the numbers applying in particular to the information communications technology side have significantly dropped.
And you mentioned special effects. I think an engineer from Trinity is up for one of the Academy Awards, in fact has won one of the Special Effect Academy Awards.
That's right, not our Oscar winner.
Yeah, indeed. You mentioned job vacancies. Now, there was a study in DCU just last month that reportedly found, I think it was nearly 14,000 vacancies in the IT sector in this country. It was a huge number. And yet, anecdotally, the response to that report, I think, has been that there are a lot of engineers out there who would like to know where these vacancies are.
There's a mixed perception, I think. You will find, for instance, in the recent months, there have been a lot of close down of some manufacturing companies. However, if you look at the overall, there has been an extremely high surplus of jobs in this country. And what we'll find is that perhaps there's jobs in particular areas in the country, for instance. But when we talk to industry and Steps to Engineering with several other stakeholders this year launched a programme called Are You Up For It.ie, which was specifically geared at trying to interest students into the electronics, computer and software and computing science areas, because we are hearing from industry that they are having huge difficulties in filling their vacancies. And as the DCU survey showed, there's a huge number just in the last year alone. And that industry, much against the perception, grew by 32% alone last year. So there is growth there. There is plenty of vacancies. So,
do we maybe need graduate programs that would kind of translate some of the engineers from traditional areas into the more newer areas?
Sure. I think as well, a lot of college programs are looking into placements, which would have been a big drive in the UK. So company sponsoring perhaps their last year and company placements. And that immediately leads you into being a more suitable candidate to go on into that company to further your career. So that's an area I think colleges are looking into also.
Okay, that's a long way from the Week of Wonder. However, let's remind people again, those events run Monday to Friday next week, and they'll find full details at the weekofwonder.ie website. Margie McCarthy from Engineers Ireland, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Mary.
The buddleia, or butterfly bush, is a common garden plant in Ireland, and indeed you'll see it growing on waste ground around our cities. It attracts clouds of butterflies of all types throughout the late summer. But in recent years, growers have reported a blackening of the shoot tips. It's commonly known as dieback, and it can seriously affect the plant. Now, it was thought that nematode worms might be responsible for this dieback. Well, in the Chagas Research Centre at Kinsealy in North County Dublin, PhD student Sinead Phelan, working under Dr. Jerry Douglas, has been studying the problem. And our reporter Terry Flanagan visited her in her laboratory to hear about her research.
Sinead, you're sitting here at what I would have called a fume cupboard, but it's not a fume cupboard.
No, it's a laminar flow cabinet. It has sterile air coming through so that your plants won't get any external contamination.
Okay, now you're working away. What you have there is you have a sample of a plant. And it's a buddleia plant from the butterfly bush. Yes. And what you want to do is you want to take a sterile sample from that, is that right?
Yes, that's it.
And transfer it onto that nutrient agar there.
Yes, that's it.
That's it. Yeah. And explain a little bit why.
Why, basically, buddleia, the butterfly bush, at the moment we are finding that it has this apical dieback problem, which has been reported here in Ireland and in Europe. So what we want to try and do is we want to produce sterile cultures free from any endogenous bacteria which are inside the plant stem and free from any fungal contamination as well.
Because the buddleia, as we know, has these beautiful blue flowers, and that's why people like them. They attract the butterflies. Right. But lately we noticed that they're not producing the flowers.
No, you get this brown dieback on the shoot, the growing part of the shoot, and you can also see these brown blotches on the leaves as well. And this produce the effect where the plant does not grow on and does not flower.
And of course then, people, when they buy this plant, they want it for the flower.
That's it.
So what you're doing, part of your PhD thesis, is to find out why.
Yes, that's it.
So you're growing these plants here. Continue on there. I'm just going to watch you as you're working away here. Cutting away.
Yeah, so basically we have our buddleia plant. And what we did was we isolated from 11 different types of bacteria from the internal part of the stem. And we've identified these.
So you've actually found 11 bacteria, which shouldn't be growing within the plant.
That's it, yeah, 11 different bacteria.
And you presume then that's the cause of your problem?
Yes, we think that these, either one of the bacteria alone or them in combination may be causing the problem of the dieback in the buddleia plants.
Now, you're just transferring...
Yep, I am.
...that sample onto your sterile dish.
Yep. So, let's throw that back in there.
And now we go to the tissue room, is it?
Yes,
tissue culture room.
So,
been in here already, and I know it's very, very noisy.
Yes, I'm very sorry. It is a bit noisy in here.
Wow, it's a mass of, first of all, banks of lights, rows and rows of fluorescent lights. And there must be, not hundreds, but thousands of samples in sterile jars, and all of them labelled. And you've put that one there into buddleia globosa, is that correct?
Yeah, that's it.
So you want to allow this to grow here?
Yes, I am. So normally it takes around 4 weeks for it to grow to produce more plants. So we leave them in here for 4 weeks before we transfer them again.
And where are they transferred to then?
You can either transfer them back into this culture media to propagate more so that you have bigger numbers, or you can root them and place them outside into the greenhouse to grow them on.
Okay, well, let's go out to the greenhouse because it's far too noisy in here. And where is your greenhouse then?
Greenhouse is just out the door here, right. So let's just take a walk on through.
Now, you've been how many years on your PhD so far?
Over 3 years doing my PhD.
So you must be finishing up pretty soon then?
Yes, in the next 2 months. Okay. So, finishing up then.
Now, we're moving outside. And oh, there's rows and rows and rows of greenhouses I see here.
Yes, that's it. So, we have the compartmental outside here where we wean most of our plants from the growth room out to this house.
Now, how many buddleias have you grown here in this greenhouse?
Oh, many. God, hundreds. I have hundreds of buddleias after growing. So once we got them free from bacteria, we wanted to propagate them on, and we wanted them to flower as well so that we knew that they flowered true to type, that when they went in, they had a blue flower, that when they came out, they had a blue flower as well.
So we're now coming into the greenhouse here, a massive greenhouse here, and somewhat noisy as well. Oh, look, there's all your plants. I can see them all here. Hundreds of them?
Yes, hundreds of Buddleia have been...
They're about what? They're about a foot tall or so there.
Yes, they are. So they've been growing now for around 4 to 6 months.
Now, these particular ones here are not in flower.
No, they're not.
But your last year's ones produced flowers.
Yes, they
100%.
All 100% produced flowers, and they all flowered true to type. So they had a blue flower going into the growth room, they had a blue flower coming back out.
And you're expecting of these hundreds that are here this year, you'd expect them to also to flower true?
Yes, we would.
So really what has happened, your micropropagation has allowed you to, first of all, to see what was causing this lack of flowering. It appears it's either one or a combination of these bacteria.
Yes, that's it.
And you have then bred these meristems.
Yep.
Which did not have the bacteria.
That's it, yeah.
And they're after breeding true.
Yes, they are.
So micropropagation really is a technique for the future.
It is, yes. Micropropagation has many advantages. You can rid any... This technique can be used for any plant or tree to rid them from any endogenous bacteria or fungal pathogens which can occur within the plant.
How do you know then that these bacteria will not reinfect these healthy plants here?
Further testing has to occur. We're in the process of doing a Cox postulate test, which basically is reinfecting these plants with the bacteria to see, in combinations as well, to see if these bacteria are actually causing the problem.
Mm.
But this is a trial in process at the moment.
And the 11 species of bacteria, are they all closely related?
No, they're all from different genuses and different families. So there's two of them are related, but the rest aren't. They're all completely different to each other.
And did you find all 11 species in all the plant samples?
No, at most we found a combination of some of them only had 3 bacteria present, others might have had 8 bacteria present, but we just look at the combinations. 3 of the bacteria which we found are present in all of the plants.
So it looks as if it's one or a combination of these three that caused the problem in the Buddleia.
Yes, this is what we think.
And you're happy that with micropropagation you've succeeded in weeding out the bacteria?
Yes, I am. So all the plants which we have produced have proved to be bacteria free and are growing, both growing and flowering quite well.
Terry Flanagan reporting there from the Chagas Research Centre in Kinsealy in North County Dublin. That's it for this week. As always, you'll find more information about the items in this week's programme on our website, rte.ie/radio1/quantum. And if you want to contact us, you can email us, quantum@rte.ie. From me, Mary Mulvihill, until next week, slán tamall.